Okay, contestant number four.
Hello, my name is Principal. Glad to be on the show. Thank you.
Okay, now we've met our contestants, let's get to the game.
Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
What does it all mean?
Music puzzles, that's how it looks. Everything's in shapes and colors and slots and the way it fits in.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from? The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast where we bring you conversations with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 98, the first half of our conversation with legendary producer Prince Paul. There was so much to discuss with him that we had to break it up into two episodes. Prince Paul is a producer and DJ who has been involved with so much great music that we hardly know where to start. He began in his teens as the DJ for the original hip-hop band, Stetsasonic. But fans really took notice when he produced De La Soul's 1989 debut album, 3 Feet High and Rising, which is generally considered one of the greatest rap albums of all time. It was the first of three classic albums Paul would work on with the group. It also, with its sarcastic humor and eclectic range of samples, set a template for the rest of the work he would produce. Paul has worked on an incredible number of projects since then, under his own name, as part of a group, and as a producer. In this segment, we talk De La and Stet, but we also discuss his group The Gravediggers, which featured a then-unknown pre-Wu-Tang Clan RZA, his work with Vernon Reid of Living Color, the Grammy-winning comedy albums he produced for Chris Rock, and his band Baby Elephant with P-Funk's Bernie Worrell. But we began by discussing his 2003 solo album, The Politics of the Business, a surprising-sounding record that was his response to the travails of the record industry. But before we get to the show, several listeners have recently asked how they can help us out to ensure that we keep bringing you new episodes every week. You can go to patreon.com/thecyphershow to become a patron and help us bring you the show you've grown to love. The Cipher will continue to be free. This is a voluntary way, if you enjoy the show, to make sure it keeps going. We even have exclusive rewards for our biggest supporters. So once again, that's patreon.com/thecyphershow. Or check out the About section of our webpage at thecyphershow.com. In addition to supporting us on Patreon, another vitally important thing you can do for the show is to rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes. The more 5-star ratings we get, the better chance we have of continuing to land amazing guests. And now, here's plug 4, aka The Orgenius, aka Chest Rockwell, aka The Undertaker, better known to all of us as Prince Paul. It's funnier actually going to see Tom Silverman today. Because I was just thinking about that, because you have Dave Chappelle kind of play a version of him
on the
Politics of the Business album.
Liked it, schmiked it. It's all backpacking music. You lucky to go double wood with that shit. Double bar doo-doo.
Yo, come on. Look, I mean, like,
this ain't the fucking 90s, all right? So why don't you go out there and get some help, some counseling or something, and stop bringing me these fucking whack-ass records and bring me some shit I can sell. It stinks.
Yeah. It's funny because when I played it for Tom, he's like, he's listening, he's like, ah, ha, ha, ha. And he's like, that kind of sounds like me. I was like, yeah, it's inspired by.
Yeah, that's kind of a, I mean, I guess might as well start there. That's like a interesting record for you, I think, like, because the beats are, you know, sort of super of the time and super commercial sounding. And coming from you, people might think that's like a parody or something, but the lyrics aren't a parody. Like the lyrics are pretty, you know, straightforward from the people.
Right. I mean, the whole concept was just a conversation that me and Tom had, and it was just based on, I finished Prince Among Thieves And I think my problem I had was, I know they didn't sign me to make a bunch of money. I think they kind of signed me to kind of give the staff something fun to do. So yeah, I signed Paul, you know, not any really big money, I know they think to promote me, but I think just like 3 Feet High and Rising, but in a lesser, you know, version of 3 Feet High and Rising, people actually liked the record. So I think it kind of took them by surprise. And then when I asked for certain things, like, can I get a t-shirt made? Can I get some extra stickers? It was like, it's not in the budget. But then I would see like other like groups, like I think that group Sex Mob. Yeah, we gave them $1 million. And I have yet to see maybe there's one video. There's like, I'm like, are you kidding? And I kind of got hurt because I thought, you know, loyalty meant something. Because I was with that label for a long time. And when I didn't get the simple things, and then the excuse was, you know, Paul, you make entire albums. It's a singles market now. It's about singles. And you know, it's not about supporting, like, the project itself. And that kind of took me for a loop. So I was like, all right, I'm going to give you a record of just that. that was a sarcasm of it. But it was at the expense of people misunderstanding what I was trying to do. You know what I'm saying? And sometimes I got to keep that in mind. Like, there is an audience. And I've always made records just for me and whoever's in the room. And it's always been that way. And, you know, times change, people change, and, you know, they analyze things differently.
Yeah, I mean, that record is like, you know, I guess, you know, hearing the background of it, it sounds a little bitter in some ways.
Oh, yeah, all my records are bitter. 3 Feet High and Rising, as happy as it sounds, it's very bitter and sarcastic. Gravediggers is definitely bitter. Psychoanalysis is bitter. You know, you figure from a guy like me who's like jokey, and Paul, he's a sense of humor. A lot of those records are kind of like therapy for me to kind of get out what I need to say, but you know, maybe in a weird passive aggressive way of getting it done, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the thing about 3 Feet High and Rising that, you know, specifically, like, I know you've talked about that record a lot in the process of making it and stuff, but there's something about it that hasn't really been gotten too much, which is, it's funny, but it's like funny in a different way than, say, like the Fat Boys were funny.
Right.
Yeah. It's like, it's different, it's drier, it's more sort of sarcastic, like you were talking about. Like, how did you figure out that you could make hip hop that way? Because it wasn't really that way before you made it.
We didn't figure it out. We just made it. You know, I think that was the thing about it is, we kind of lived in our own bubble, you know what I'm saying? And probably more so me, but I think collectively at that time we did. And it's like our private jokes. I mean, a lot of things were just like I said, was in the room. It's like we hung out for like a day or two. I'm sure if we went out, we seen somebody with a funny hat. Yeah, the funny hat, ha ha ha. And that's just between us. And that's what 3 Feet High and Rising was. And, you know, I think coming from Long Island, you know, kind of looking outside, you know, at other, the way other people took hip hop, it almost became a parody of itself. And we just thought it was just kind of funny. You know, it's like, I got a chain, but my chain's bigger. I got a hat, my hat's bigger. And everything was just like more in excess. And we just took it as, you know, it was just funny. You know, it's like, I don't know. But there's one thing about sarcasm that I always have to keep in mind, that you have to be intelligent enough to see two sides of the coin. Because some people will get it, and some people will get butthurt about it and go, oh, what is this? Or they just don't get it at all.
Yeah.
So I always have to be wary of that.
did people get hurt? I mean, in a sense, like by the second De La record, you were poking fun at gangster rap.
Now I hold my crotch because I'm top notch. I run up off like Sasquatch and I like to eat live crab. I got 5 people to scab, but you can find me directly on the app.
You were poking fun at Hip House. Did you ever hear back? You ever get any pushback on any of that stuff?
No, you know what kind of happened is, yeah, it was a shame because Jungle Brothers made that.
Girl House.
Girl out house.
You in my hut now. When you're in my hut. You know what's up.
you know, but. A lot of it was, you know, people just took it, okay, that's those guys. You know, I kind of gave me a pass on a few things of having that reputation that, you know, luckily I didn't get beat up. People are like, oh, that's just Paul. You know, oh, that's just De La, you know, and that just pushed the limits.
Definitely. I wanted to start way, way back with you for a second. One of the threads running through your whole career is, you know, the eclecticism of your samples, of your approach. And I feel like that goes back to the kind of radio you were hearing growing up. What was the radio you remember from like the 70s from growing up?
Man, when I was young, in the early 70s, it was WWRL 16 radio. Hank Stray.
20 at WWRL in the news. Percy Sutton backs A. Beam for mayor. We'll have details at 3:40. Jeff Barnes reporting WWRL's 2020 news. This is Hank Spann with the Godfather, James Brown.
I don't even remember FM radio being popping back then. And you had, I don't know, Frankie Crock. I don't know when Frankie Crock come on, BLS.
WBLS.
Frankie! The Frankie Crock in the house, he can get three pieces.
Tall, tan, young, and fly. Anytime you want me, baby, reach out for me, I'm your guy. Just as good to you as it is for you. You get so much with the Frankie Crocker touch. After all, how can you lose with the stuff I use? Really? All I have to do is set the needle to the track, separate the soul from the wax, lay in the groove, and hope to make you move.
But there was, I can't remember his name. Oh, he's the guy who started, hey, you know, what's the people in the place to be? But and all the MC started biting his sound. Oh, I can't remember his name. It'll come to me at some point. But yeah, it was during those times. And to me, like radio back then, especially black radio, played everything. You know, it wasn't just, you know, like now it's like, oh, all hip-hop and R&B, and that's all we play. And it was, wow, okay, there's Rick D's Disco Duck. There's the Bee Gees. There's James Brown, Parliament Funkadelic. Oh, wow, ABBA. You know what I'm saying? So it kind of spanned different genres and different sounds. I mean, just as long as it was funky, you know, it seemed to get played. And I think once you have that, it makes you want to explore other music. You know, okay, I wonder what else the Bee Gees made. Oh, okay, I wonder what else. Who did they work with? You know, I think having liner notes being from that time kind of helps too, because then you go, whoa, then it's almost like a puzzle. It's a, you know, it's like, wow, okay, it's like you see a sighing stuff, you're putting it all on the board in front of you. Oh, this matches, and he was at this scene of the crime, and it's a beautiful thing. I don't think you really get that too much anymore. I mean, maybe via Google, but it was just kind of fun, the process.
Yeah. And another kind of person who was a big influence on you as far as like taking stuff from all over the place was Bambaataa, I know.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt, man. Like, I don't think Bambaataa gets enough credit. Like, he gets more credit based on organizing angry youth and converting it into hip-hop, you know, in a more peaceful manner than he gets.
Which is no small feat, to be fair.
Oh, no. But overall, it all is based on the music first and foremost. I think people kind of forget that. Like, Bambaataa organizing the youth without the music, he might not have organized the youth. So I think that, to me, that was, you know, where people looked at that part, which I admire and I respect. I always looked at, yo, what is that record? Like, there's records that have tapes of Bambaataa now that even with our fine system of Googling and everything else, I have no idea what it is, you know? And I'm like, it's amazing to me.
Did you ever get to see him spin in person, or was it only via like tapes you would get?
Back in those days.
Yeah, back in those days.
In the mid '80s, once or twice, and the rest of that was just tapes. So when I, you gotta understand, like dudes like that, when I was a kid, you know, in the 80s was like, they were like rock stars because you'd hear the tapes and it's almost like mythological creatures. Like, wow, they do exist. And you might make them bigger in your head because there is no video. You don't see them. And you look at them, you hear the music, and then finally you get to see them. It's like, oh my God, like they're amazing. And it's funny coming to realize later, I mean, probably excluding Bambada, but a lot of those guys were only a few years older than me. You know what I'm saying? Like, wow, we're kind of peers, you know, in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And there was one thing about, you know, growing up where you did, you knew a lot of people, Biz and Rakim and all of these people sort of before they settled into who they were. And in some cases, even before they settled into the names we now know them as. Who had the worst rap name before they settled on the one we know them as?
Oh, man. I think Rakim was the Wiz Kid Love, I think, or something like that.
That's pretty bad.
Yeah, which Rakim kind of worked. I'm not stating it's bad. I'm just stating it was of the time. Because there was a lot of Chili This and whatever skis back then. Biz used to call himself Busy B.
This was before the other Busy B?
He just swiped it because kids were ignorant back then and didn't know what Busy B looked like. And so he was telling everybody he was Busy B. And until like guys like me and a few other guys debunked him and go, you're not Busy B. Then at some point it became Biz Markie. But I know Biz since I was 15 years old.
Yeah.
15, 14?
You used to DJ for him when you guys were about that age.
Yeah, right? Yeah. He used to come by the house and, you know, it was weird, and I have a lot of respect for Biz because, you know, all those songs they made in the early days about him being teased about looking a certain way and, you know, people, you know, kind of exclude him. It was very true because, you know, I'd bring him around. Like, he was a friend first and foremost, and people, you know, you hear it like, look at him. And for him to have the success that he has is such a get back, you know what I'm saying? And maintain his success has been even more amazing. You know, he's in the class of least likely to succeed, who's, you know, succeeded beyond anybody's expectations. I'm sure even his own, so.
Yeah. And one other thing about you growing up, I read that you used to do this kind of like What's Up Tiger Lily style, like overdubbing of karate movies and old movies.
Man, you got
and stuff
a lot
with dialogue.
Yeah.
Who were some of your like comedic influences, do you think, since you were starting that young with that kind of stuff?
Man, I was dubbing videotapes, man. That was cool.
First of all, do you still have any of those?
Yeah, I still have it. I showed it to MTV when they came by the house and filmed that thing for De La Soul, where you see me with the sampler and I'm playing the Mickey Mouse Club thing.
If you have a creative mind, you can basically use anything. For example, I could take a record such as a basic Disneyland Mickey Mouse record, for example. Now, people may not believe it, but if you look through these old records, you could find things like drum beats on them. It's hard to believe, though.
Which De La really kind of got mad at me about because I kind of exposed what we did. Yeah, I played it for them then because I thought it was cool. It's like, yo, check this out. And they kind of like, yeah, juvenile humor. But then years later, they put out Kung Fu or whatever, which was pretty ironic to me. I'm like, oh man, you know, it's like, but that's Paul's 10 years before it becomes popular. Let me see, comedy. You know what I liked a lot as a kid, beside, you know, obviously Richard Pryor was big in those days, but Cheech and Chong. And a lot of it was just watching these weird B movies and seeing the sense of humor in that, you know. And I've kind of been, I won't say weird, but kind of just in my own like world of like I could sit out on the street and if there's enough people, I could just be content all day. Like, you know, just laughing at certain things or just seeing the humor and things. And I'm still like that to this day. Like, you know, it's just me, you know.
Yeah.
It's hard to describe.
And so when you were a teenager, what were you like, seven, when you joined STET, you were like Set Sonic, you were how old, like 16, 17?
Yeah, I was like 16 years old, turning 17. And that Set Sonic easily was like the best thing that's ever happened to me, you know, because it launched everything for me, you know, and I always try to give those guys that do respect and credit. Because, you know, you don't hear about that too often. People talk about STET.
Well, there's one thing the sort of famous about Stet that I wanted to ask you about, which was Go Stetso was basically like the Stick Up Kid anthem.
We boogie to the DJs nonstop to the sound of the Brooklyn hip hop. And if you've ever seen Brooklyn rock, Brooklyn rock.
Right, people would get robbed all the time.
Oh yeah, yeah,
that record came on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was, you put that in the Latin quarters, and immediately a fight would erupt. Random stabbings, and you know, girls getting their jewelry snatched. The good old days of hip hop. Yeah.
What was it like for you at that age to be like, yeah, I'm doing the cuts on that. That's my song.
I don't know if that really fascinated me as much as hearing your record the first time on the radio, which was Just Say Stet. Now, that blew my mind. Every radio was on in the house. Mom, yo, you know, playing it in a club was cool, and seeing people react to it was cool. But I think I was really kind of focused on two things, and that was, at the time, was probably girls and being safe. So the club wilding out and dancing was kind of not in my focus at the time. And
but
yeah,
you did see that a few times, I'm assuming, people wiling out to...
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, there was Ghost Stets, it was definitely the song that ended the party. I think Funky by the Ultra Magnetic. Man, I'm trying to figure out another record that was like that. But yeah, definitely Ghost Stets, I remember, was pretty violent.
And something that kind of is underappreciated about that era is your DJing on those Stet records. I know you were always trying to innovate and do stuff people hadn't seen. On Just Say Stet, the song you just mentioned, you're like scratching one word there sort of towards the middle of the song.
Yeah, oh man, you know, people fail to realize, like, DJing was my claim to fame. I mean, that's how I got in Stet. That's how people knew me. And I was battling people, and I took pride in the cuts, and I was cutting syllables like that funky, funky.
But if you can't say it all, just say Stet, 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 funky.
Now it seems like so, like, prehistoric at this time, but in those days, it's like, yo, he's breaking down the syllables, you know, saying the scratches in the middle. I listen to it now, I'm like, whoa. I mean, I really, at one point in my life, probably more so in high school, I really thought, like, yo, nobody can beat me. I'm that nice. Like, I practiced so much. I love music. That was put like this. Every day, all the conversation was music, 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 music. Even with girls, hey, music, music, music. Want to kiss? Music, 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 music. Let's go out to eat. Music, music, music. And so I was so locked in and focused and so passionate about it at that time that, man, like, cuts were everything to me. And it's funny, I you know, that's, nobody even talks about that.
Yeah, well, there's On Fire, too, which has a lot of fast turntable stuff that you do.
Yeah, you know, but aside from Just Say Stet, On Fire, the album itself, and the single that you're talking about, wasn't representative of what I was able to do, because in the studio I was limited. I remember, you know, I would come in like, yo, let's blah blah blah, and I'm, you know, because I want to show off. This is my first record. I want to show people how nice I am, and my voice is my cuts. You know what I'm saying? I don't have rhymes. I just want to. But I remember Daddy-O going, nah, man, like Jam Master Jay, go like this, bent, 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 then stop it. I'm like, no, because he's trying to orchestrate cuts. And I'm like, I'm trying to show the skill side of the cuts. And, you know, he was the older one in the group, and he was the leader, so he won. So a lot of those things just never made it. So some of those cuts on that album is Daddy-O cutting, because he was just like, he didn't trust me to do it, you know.
you were by far the youngest member of the group.
Yeah, at the time. Until Bobby came in the group. And I think me and Bobby were around the same age, Bobby Simmons. But yeah. Yeah. It was a kid, man. Yeah. It's a kid in a room full of men, you know. So it was different.
So you think you were maybe listened to a little less than some of the other guys because of your age?
Not at all, because I started record collecting clearly when I was about 4 or 5 years old. And, you know, my dad was a huge jazz collector. My mom, you know, listened to whatever's on the radio. My siblings were teenagers, so of course they're going to listen to, you know, whatever's new. Oh, I got this cat, I got the new cassette of whatever, you know, that came out, you know, new 45. So I was way ahead of the curve on all the kids, definitely kids my age, but I was there with the adults. Like, I could rattle off songs, who made it. I would sit there and gaze at a 45, you know, and kind of look at it spin on the turntable. I mean, there's such beautiful things about having wax and growing up in those days that you just don't get anymore. And, you know, so I was really into that for a while. Like, I would ask my mom, you know, where kids wanted toys. I was like, can I get a record player? I had a Mickey Mouse record player. I had a few other record players. I damaged one of them because I tried to do pottery on it because I seen it on TV. And I was like, wow, it spins just like a pottery wheel. I put some Play-Doh on it, some water, and it was a wrap. it did not work. Theoretically, it worked.
Right.
So I went through a few record players. So by the time I got to 8 years old, I stopped collecting. There was no toys for me. I was like, I don't want toys. Like, you know, just records and anything dealing with audio equipment.
Yeah. So one final Stead thing, like very particular. So Talking All That Jazz is maybe their most well-remembered tune.
Right.
You use a sample, just for a second, of Juicy Fruit in it.
Said it was an art, so now we're gonna rip you apart.
Stop. Check it out, my man. This is the music of a hip-hop band, jazz.
Which is kind of a dig at Entombe, the guy who made the comments about sampling that inspired the song.
Yeah, that's the brilliance of Daddy-O. Like, he when he wrote that, you know, it was, that kind of struck a nerve, because I remember Entombe talked about don't quote me, but just how sampling wasn't, you know, creative, and it wasn't an art, and it wasn't this and that.
We got into the conversation of sampling, and this is what I said. Sampling should be a tool for creativity, not a substitute for it. And I said, if you're going to sample somebody's music, pay them. Since my point was, and trust me, most of the cats early on were not getting a dime. I remember Lonnie Liston Smith calling me when he was glad they sampled it. I said, what? You got to get paid. Because my thing, it would be just as unfair for me to take Biggie's rap and put in one of my songs and call it my song.
That's where that record spawned from, was from, you know, from that. My role in that was laying the beat down and having New Kirk come in and play the keyboards. But it's a shame, man, because I would have liked to have gotten credit for that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, not to get into it a ton, but there was a lot of stuff that you basically produced for them.
Co-produced.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely had my hand in a lot of stuff. Like, I'll never take
credit. Did you think of it as production at the time, or was it just like, hey, we're, you know, this is what the group does?
I didn't know anything. I was a kid. Like, literally, and I say this, you know, not just like showing how stupid I am, but I was just so happy to be there. You know, it was just like, you got to understand, like, me making records and being in that position was not even in my dreams. You know, people's like, yes, it would be my father's dream. It wasn't in the dream, because to me, it wasn't even possible. Like, LL Cool J, Fat Boys, Run DMC, they make records, you know, but, you know, me, like, how do I fit in that equation? So me being in the studio and signing a contract was like, okay. You know, I was just going to go to college and be an audio engineer and eventually take the civil service test and become a postman, you know what I'm saying? So I didn't pay attention to a lot of those things, nor did I really care at that point. It's not until afterwards, when you see somebody with way more things than you have with the same job, you go, whoa, that's a nice gold chain and nice car or whatever. You got a lot of nice things in this house. You know, but we have the same job, you know, that then that's when you start.
Sure. And then you ended up at, once that kind of petered out, you ended up hooking up with De La. Originally through, you got asked to do a beat for a guy named Gangster B.
Oh yeah, Gangster B.
Who, good so guy. Who was Gangster Riley. B?
Gangster B was an MC from Amityville, Long Island, that Maceo, who was the DJ for De La Soul, was his DJ at the time. He was DJ for both groups. And he was recording a single for our teacher named Mr. Everett Collins, who was the drummer at that time for the Isley Brothers. I'm not sure in what capacity, but that was his claim for fame. And he was also our music teacher at the school. And I guess he was at that time starting a record label, and Gangsta B, I believe, might have been one of the first artists on that label. And me being the guy who made the record in the neighborhood, you know, I was like, Paul, he's a like, he made a record, you know, gave me almost like an edge to, you know, I had the know-how of how to do this hip hop thing. So, you know, invite Paul to the studio. He had me program a beat. I didn't like how the beat turned out because I had a drum machine back then. As a matter of fact, I still have it, and I still use it to this day. It's called a Sequential Tom by Sequential Circuits. And the cool thing about that drum machine is back then it had a reverse button on it, which was so cool. You could reverse the kicks, the snares. It had cartridges that, with sounds you could reverse, like bongo. So, you know, at the song then was Paul Revere. I was like, oh, and I was like, oh, wow. You know, I think with Paul Revere, they actually took the tape and played it backwards. But I had a drum machine that did that, and they wanted to make a beat like that. I programmed it. I was like, you know, back in the 80s, biting was a crime, you know what I'm saying, which it isn't anymore. But, you know, it was a crime, and it pained me to do it. And Maceo, like I said, approached me and said, hey, you know, I know this isn't your thing. And he looks in pain. I'm looking in pain. He's like, I got a group, De La Soul. Why don't you work with us? And that's how the whole thing began.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously the first record, you know, went gold. It was huge. I was looking at the video not long ago to Me, Myself, and I. And when I originally saw it, when it came out, like, I was young and didn't sort of really get the intricacies of the rap world. But in a lot of ways, it's pretty vicious towards Def Jam.
I don't believe this, man.
Yo, Duff, who they put you with, man?
I got Def Beat, man.
Yo, man, they stuck me and Mace with Def Beat, too.
I mean, you know.
Yeah, not towards Def Jam at all. I think it was just to the culture itself. You know what I'm saying? Like, now, Def Jam was probably at the forefront, but not at all at Def Jam.
Not specifically towards them.
Nah. Now, Def Beat is just because everybody said Def back then, you know, so it was a kind of poke on the culture itself.
Okay. But yeah, it was like definitely poking fun at a lot of aspects of.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. You see the arms folded. You know, I got Adidas thing on now. How ironic is that? As I say, ironic throughout this whole interview because everything is irony when it comes to Paul. You know.
Yeah.
But yeah. I mean, we were just like that, you know, and we fed off of each other being that sarcastic, and you know, being Long Island, there was a certain snootiness to you that you had, like, oh god, this really can your shoelaces get any wider, you know what I'm saying? It was just like, at some point it just became to this point of absurdity, and as I said before, hip-hop just started becoming a parody of itself, and you're like, I'm more hip-hop than you, you know. It was just crazy.
Yeah. And you had, you know, the follow-up record to that, De La Soul Is Dead, was in a lot of ways a reaction to the success of the first one.
Yeah.
And on Past the Plugs, you know, Dove talks about Tommy Boy wanting another Say No.
Radio works it, public consumes it, Tommy Boy wants another Say No.
Right?
They yeah.
So what kind of pressure were you feeling from the label making that?
You know, the weird part is initially the label with 3-4-9 Rising didn't really think the record would probably do that well. You know what I'm saying? Like, you could tell. Like, they might not say that, you know. But you could tell, you know, it was like, yeah, no, you know, because they never really had a success like that. I mean, maybe they had like Planet Rock, but an album that had that magnitude, you know, it kind of threw us for a loop. So at that point, you know, when all eyes are on you and you got this hot group and, you know, you got the next record, they're putting that pressure on the group to kind of, you know, rehash that success again. And the group didn't want to be that way. Like, they were very rebellious. You got to understand, like, these are the guys who's always like, you know, we kind of do our own thing, you know, throw the sarcasm in it, you know, biting is a crime. You know, there's all these things that go along with it. And just being an artist that kind of didn't want us to do the same thing. And yeah, you know, the pressure from the label is always going to be, we made a lot of money. Let's make a lot of money again, yeah. You know? And but they were smart enough, at least Monica Lynch was smart enough to kind of give us our freedom to be us, you know what I'm saying? Because that's what got us there, so.
Yeah, and, you know, by the third one, by Balloon Mind State, it's, the group seems almost, they're really reckoning with, you know, their public image, with their fame, with how they want to be perceived. Funny, funny.
State of fusing, I'm a user to the ruling, not the trickle, caught a rush, but I played hush, while Andres Titus did the grabbing, as a pair we put the hearts to mush, lush to Lee, I would hear the public beat, the same went for Titus when he blacked the sheep, but as the knee went deep to deeper off the chart, the album faded to black, that's when the amnesia starts.
You know, they want to be seen sort of as full people and not kind of one-dimensional rappers or whatever. What were those sessions like? I feel like it's only now people are really starting to appreciate that record.
You know, it was a tough time, I think, for the group, because one, they had all the success of 3 Feet High and Rising. When De La Soul's Dead came out and people failed to realize that there was articles that, you know, I think I still have them. De La Soul is dead. You know, they was like, people were looking for the first album. So the second album not selling as much was considered a failure, even though the Source magazine gave it 5 mics, you know what I'm saying? Overall, people, now people look back like, oh, that album was great. But then when it came out, I was like, So here comes this next record. And, you know, now everybody's life as individuals have changed too. You know, kids come into play. There's, you know, guys started moving, getting their own places and, you know, learning how to do production on their own. So it's a growing up thing that had a lot to do with it, and it wasn't just you know, a collective as a group, like, let's go in and do this. It was just individually.
Yeah.
And I was still the same stupid guy, which kind of conflicted somewhat, but, you know, we got it done. It was, to me, it was a very insightful record to make, because, like I said, we learned a lot about musicianship working with Fred Wesley and Maceo Parker and, you know, all, you know, the JBs more or less. And working more with Bob Power this time around and trying to...
Well, you were the first person to work with Bob Power, right? Wasn't Stet the first hip-hop group that he worked with?
I don't know. Is it? That's what he said?
I think Daddy-O... I think I read that Daddy-O said that in an interview
Yeah, I don't know. But yeah, I remember Bob from those days. But he wasn't like... At that time, he was Bob Power... lowercase, but at this point it was Bob Power, all caps. You know what I'm saying? There was a difference. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, and that you know, a lot of it changed. It was that album, you know, was cool to make, but it wasn't as smiley as the other records to make.
Yet for some reason, comedians love that record. You said that Chris Rock, that's his favorite, and
yeah, it was weird. Him and I remember Dave Chappelle. When I recorded him doing the Chris Rock record, they were like, he's like, yeah, man, Prince Paul, Balloon Mind State. It's like, it's the first thing that comes to mind. I mean, that was, to me, the record that kind of ended it with me and De La Soul was Balloon Mind State. So, you know, and same thing with Chris. Chris was like, yo, I love that album. And that, and listening to Psychoanalysis prompted him to contact me to produce his first record. So, well, second record, technically. So that was weird. Another irony.
That the dark one with, you know, fantasies of murder and stuff is the thing that got you a gig making a comedy record.
Many ironies of the life of Prince Paul.
Yeah. You're in kind of a unique place as far as, like, hip-hop generations go. As far as, like, you know, started out as kind of the young guy in sort of the generation that included, like, P and... you know, maybe even like Run DMC and LL and that sort of initial crew of people. And then, but you also have a key role as sort of an elder statesman, even though you were only like a year or so older, with the kind of Native Tongues movement. What was it like for you? Did you see yourself as kind of a bridge between those two sort of generations?
Yeah, I mean, without a doubt, because, you know, I can go inside like a, you know, it was weird because, you know, in the thing with, let's say, in the company of, let's say, of Ultramagnetic or Just Ice and all these other people, we were kind of like in that generation. But then you go back a little bit to like the Flash and all those guys, we would consider New Jacks. But then, like I said, or how you just stated, you know, I'm the elder statesman when it comes to like the native tongue. So I was in a weird position and not too far in age from any of those given rap generations. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, a lot of it had to do with when I started. You know, my first record came out in 85, and I started when I was 18. So people just look at me as like, I've been around forever, which now it seems like forever. But then it was just like, whoa. Because hip-hop drastically changed the sound from 85 to 89. I mean, light years, you know? And so when you listen to those records, it was so archaic that they're like, whoa. In 4 years to a kid who's like 14 or 18 is you would totally
right, it's your whole
person.
Life.
Yeah, you're like, oh, whoa, that's crazy.
Yeah. So you mentioned, you know, working with like a lot of the JBs on the third De La Soul album. And that gets to something I wanted to talk to you about, like working with instrumentalists generally. Like you've worked with a lot of guys who were just sort of virtuoso instrumentalists, right? People like Bernie Worrell, Fred Wesley, Maceo Parker, Vernon Reed, who you've, you know, known for,
oh, yeah, Vern,
for a very long
man.
Time.
Yeah.
When you're working with someone like that, who's just like a virtuoso at their instrument, and you're in a production side, sort of what role do you play?
That sounds whack. That sounds great. That's it right there. you know, and I always bring my friend Newkirk, who's more like music theory savvy than I am. So where I can't express it, you know, it's like, yeah, let's take that. And, you know, and just in very simplistic hip hop terms, he'll go, yeah, do a major seven, you know, the sharp one, the G and blah, 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 blah. And it kind of works out. You know, some musicians need that, some don't, mm-hmm. you know. But I kind of pride myself on, like, hearing things, you know. And that, I mean, obviously that's what a producer does, but... You know, like, yeah, that's it. You know, and then trying to figure out how to get the best performance at that given situation. You know, because some things, especially musicians, they're apt to just be, you know, technically this is wrong. Forget about how technical it is. This is how it feels. I don't care if one of the keys is off. I don't care, whatever. It's how it moves with the track and vibes and how it hits your soul. And sometimes you have to remind people, you know, even as accomplished as they are, that's what's important, you know. That's what, you know, it's almost like even with MCs, I always feel as though, you know, there's a kid in some other country who doesn't understand the language, but they like the way it fits and the way it flows in the music. And to me, that's more important. And lyricists hate this, but to me, I say more than the words. You know, if I could close my eyes and it feels and it flows right, I mean, there's plenty of MCs, I will name no names, that don't have great rhymes, but they fit in the pocket and they seem to work with the beat and it makes the song great, you know. And then you have somebody with these incredible lyrics that you're like, yo, something lady, want to go and flow? And you're like, okay, technically it's all right and it's whatever, but and there's a few jewels in there, quote unquote, but it will never get heard again because people are like, it's just hard to listen to.
I think, you know, you've been open that one of your strengths as a producer, less so than like the beat making, is like the arrangement and like you said, working with vocalists.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be the first one to say I don't think I'm the best beat maker. You know, I think I make things that are cool and I make things that I like, you know, but on a commercial level, you know, I could probably make it because I can parody stuff, so I can make it if I wanted to, but, and you're right, like I always pride myself in taking nothing and making it to something. Like, you know, everybody gets used in my records. If I was recording a record now and I go, hey, I need your voice to be the garbage man in the skit that I'm doing. You know, there's always something. Somebody has a talent.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what I do, you know, and I like that. I like arranging. I like it's puzzles. I don't like doing puzzles per se, but music puzzles, that's how it looks. Everything's in shapes and colors and slots and the way it fits in. And even before Pro Tools came out, that's how I always saw music. I always saw it kind of in that, you know, weird kind of puzzly type way, and just piecing it together.
Yeah. And, you know, you haven't worked obviously only with rappers. You know, we talked, you did a record with Vernon Reid. You've done a couple of comedy things. With the comedy stuff specifically, like, what did you take away, like, working with comics that maybe you brought back to the music world? Because you've worked with, you know, some of the best over the years, you know, Chappelle, Chris Rock, and Don Novello, who does Father Guido Sarducci, and, you know, on the Chris Rock album, Sykes was on that.
Yeah, there's, like, tons of people. Is,
yeah.
You know, Jim Brewer, is. I think we recorded Market Cho one time, and, you know, there's always tons of people that came in. The one thing I took from it is, man, making records could be fun. Sometimes working with rappers, you know, as time went on, it's very stressful, man. You know, it's catering the ego. It's hoping they trust you. It's, you know, it's a lot of things. But, you know, the cool thing about working with Chris Rock and with comedians, they'll do their take and they'll go, so what do you think? You think the punchline's strong? Do you think I should do this? And I'm like, yeah, that works. So let's change that. Oh, yeah, great. They'll redo it. It's no problem. It's all about the jokes, all about the setup of the joke, the punch, you know, how to landscape things, putting the music behind it. And it's like, do what you do. You know, and I'm like, wow, you know, that's it? Yeah. We're going to go out and, you know, get a latte, you know. you figure it out, you know, which puts a lot of pressure on me. But at the same time, it's nice to have them think, well, that's why we hired you.
Right, and you did two full albums with Chris.
Yeah, actually, I did three.
You did
the
three.
Third one, which was Never Scared, I was supposed to get, what kind of credit? It was an executive production credit. And somehow, in the world of ironies, I got, like, almost no credit. And it was all in my contract, and the label's like, oops, we messed up. When we print the next batch, which there wasn't going to be no next batch,
right,
we'll make the correction.
Damn.
And so, you know, I got, and that's messed up because that record won a Grammy. Like, all three of the Chris Rock records won Grammys, but it'd been nice to have a big executive production stamp instead of, like, producer. You know, producer's nice.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, that guy, you know what I'm saying, on that record. So, you know, it happens.
Yeah. And, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't ask, you know, jumping around a little bit about the Gravediggers, you know, record that you did that a lot of people love, that I really love, that I think is great, that, you know.
Thank you.
You made at a point at which, like, you kind of made that out of anger. Like, you were, people were saying, oh, he's past his prime.
Yeah, no,
he's 26. Washed up, and you were 26.
26, 20, turned 27. Yeah, you know. That record, it might be, like, my favorite record. I don't particularly care for my records that much. You know, I appreciate them and I like them and I thank them for what they've done for me and my family and, you know, how it's helped me in life. But that's one record that I listen to and I still feel to this very day. It's just because the circumstance we were in. Like, you know, RZA was in some trouble back then. I'm not at liberty to say what. Poetic was homeless at the time, kind of bouncing around. Fuquan wasn't Instead anymore. Well, we weren't saying anymore, but I think he was making clothes, living somewhere in some apartment or something. And we were all rejects, you know. I had my deal with Russell Simmons, this record label called Doodoo Man that just failed.
We'll definitely come back to that. Some good stuff,
yeah.
that never saw the light of day.
Oh,
on
God.
There.
Yeah, and then, you know, RZA got dropped from Tommy Boy. Poetic did a whole album, thought it was going to get put out, and had his manager call him saying that the label dropped him. You know, I don't know what happened to Fuquan. He was just, he's one of those missing action guys. And to put us all together and collectively make something, to me, it was gratifying. I don't believe in limitations. You know, you limit yourself. You know, you could be your own worst enemy, and I'm a full believer in that.
Yeah, so the Gravediggers, like all of you were coming out of really, you know, difficult positions, and that got put into the album. And so there's still some pretty shocking stuff on there, even now. Like, you listen to like 1-800-SUICIDE.
I'm the resurrector, be my sacrifice. Commit suicide and I bring you back to life. The first was convinced, stuck a water hose in his mouth, fat for blast, so his head can explode. Second one said, that's good, but I could top it. Put an axe up to his head and then he chopped it. Blood shot out in every direction. The rats didn't know what to do. I made suggestions. Put a slug in your mug, overdose on a drug, wet your hands, stick a knife in the plug.
Some of the stuff on there is still pretty shocking. What do you remember about that song specifically, coming up with the concept and maybe like your reactions to some of the stuff people were saying on it?
Oh, I thought it was cool. But back then it was just like, to me, my career was over anyway. So, you know, to a certain extent, so I had nothing to lose. And I just wanted to make a record that just was going to freak people out, you know. And I had the song and it had the KRS-One loop, Suicide, and they wrote to it. And I was like, that's going to freak people out. That's going to be fun. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I don't know. It's weird. It, you know, and then like I had mentioned one time, like Dolores C. Tucker had our picture on TV one time and was talking bad about the group and how, you know, hip hop is bad, and along with Tupac and other people that she put up there. And I was like, whoa, I thought it was cool.
See, Dolores Tucker, along with Bill Bennett and Senators Joe Lieberman and Sam Nunn, led a crusade in the mid-90s against rap and rock music they deemed pro-drug and obscene. Tucker, who marched with Martin Luther King in Selma, targeted artists such as Wu-Tang Clan, Tupac, Ghetto Boys, Onyx, Cypress Hill, and of course, Gravediggers. She also fought against the NAACP's decision to nominate late rapper Tupac Shakur for one of its Image Awards and filed a $10 million lawsuit against his estate for comments that the rapper made in his song, How Do You Want It, on the album All Eyes on Me, in which Shakur rapped, "See Dolores Tucker, use a motherfucker." Other artists who have had less than nice things to say about Tucker and lyrics include The Game, Jay-Z, Lil' Kim, Lil Wayne, and Eminem, who said in a D12 song, "Tell that C. Dolores Tucker slut to suck a dick." Controversial to the end, censorship advocates consider her a hero, while many consider her a moralistic and corrupt opportunist looking to make a buck.
And then people try to, you know, jump, you know, kind of join the bandwagon. Well, you know, this person tried to commit suicide. They heard heard your record, and you know, I feel bad about that, but I don't think it was true at all, because it's talk about, you know, being bit by alligator and stick your finger in a plug. It was very sarcastic, you know, but I, you know.
Yeah. And, you know, despite it having a hard time kind of finding a home initially, it sounds a lot more accessible now than I think it did in like 93, 94.
Yeah, it's weird, man. The record came out, and I tell you, man, it's always a 10-year Prince Paul thing. Like, I make it, then, with the exception maybe 3 Feet High and Rise, and it's always 10 years later. It's always, you know, wow, this is cool. But when it came out, it's like, yeah. And that's what it weighed the Gravediggers. To me, you know, people, you know, they're looking out like, oh, the record was mildly successful. And I'm like, not in the landscape of the way records were selling then. You understand? Like, then it was like, wow, gold, 400,000, this 100,000, you know. So when we sell, let's say 400,000 or under 400,000, you know, at a given time, it's a failure, you know, especially all the work you put in, you know. So I'm like, wow. Nowadays, I sold 400,000, be like, whoa.
Right.
I'd have pulled up in a Bentley in the front.
Right. Anyone would be excited about that these days. So when I met you for the first time in NYU, you told me a funny story about We Love You, Rakim.
Oh, we love you, Rakim.
The feeling mutual, love.
Oh, we love you, Rakim.
Oh, do you?
Oh, we love you, Rakim. Oh, Rakim.
When I walk down the block, the girls stop and clock. They hop on my jock because I got mad props. Tall and slim with the brown skin complexion. Have them sweating, my love and affection.
About how you sort of inadvertently ended up with doing some co-production on
that
song.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Rakim, a.k.a. the RZA, me and him, I've known him since 89, maybe. And his manager, Mel Kwan, is the one who introduced us because he wanted me to work with RZA. And, you know, talking to RZA, you know, became friends, became cool. And they were like, yo, we're going to go into the studio. And I suggested they go into Clyde because that's where I worked at. And they had an idea. I'm not sure. Maybe RZA had the loop. And I was showing them how to, because they had an SP-12 there. I was like, real simple. I'll just program to be. I'm sure you had to program the drum machine. You can make whatever drum machine, you know, beat you want. But just as a guide, I'm going to show you how it goes, you know. And I kind of programmed the beat underneath, thinking that when I left it, they was going to erase it and redo it. Later on, when I heard the record, I was like, hey, that's the same beat. They never changed it. I mean, the loop is provided by RZA, but just the percussion, the drums itself is something I programmed. I'm not taking pride in it. No, I'm trying to claim it and go, yo, I want my money. It was just startling, you know, because yeah. he was a friend, you know. And I think the reason why me and him have stayed cool is I respect and you know, consider him a friend and, you know, of his talents and everything way before he became famous. You know, like afterwards, you know, after the Wu-Tang blew up, then everybody's like, oh, the RZA. But man, when he was struggling, you know, there wasn't really people checking for him. And I always thought he was brilliant. I was, you know, I always tell him that. I was like, yo, you, to me, are that dude, you know, like.
It's interesting because I feel like a lot of producers have kind of mixed feelings about RZA. Like, oh, his stuff is like offbeat or weird or tough to DJ with or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, the early stuff to me is a little more passionate than his older stuff. You know what I'm saying? And that's just his style. You know what I'm saying? And I respect him for just doing what he does. And it was successful. Like, who's to argue? But, you know, RZA can be very hit or miss, too. I mean, just like all producers. I mean, he can go someplace, like, far left.
Samurai Showdown. Samurai Showdown. Showdown. Yo, hey, DTN, yo. How dare you challenge me? You will die for the tip of my sword today. You're too anxious. You must remain calm.
Yo, it's born, born, young lord, raise your swords. It's born, born, young lord, raise your swords.
I'm like, what is that? To something that's like super duper, like want to punch you in your face hip hop music.
With the feedback block, we don't need that. It's 10 o'clock, oh, where the fuck's your seat at? Feeling mad hostile, ran out apostle. Throwing like Christ when I speaks the gospel. Stole with the holy roll, then attack the globe with the buckets. Style the ruckus, 10 times 10 men committing mad sin. Turn the other cheek and I'll break your fucking chin. Slain boom.
To, you know, something that's like, you know, kind of middle of the road.
Yo, our parents didn't play. She couldn't even come out to play on a school day. Thought she was gonna give me some on April Fool's Day.
But no way.
Nah.
No
way. No.
So he, you know, he's all over the place. But I don't know. To me, he anybody who kind of does their own thing in spite of what people feel are popular always gets my respect. And that's even with Kanye. Like, people are like, you like Kanye? You know, I'm not a fan of all his songs, but I do respect the fact that he made 808 and Heartbreaks, and then Graduation. Then he, you know, all these other, like, you know, records that don't even kind of assemble together. You know what I'm saying? Like, he's like, I'm doing whatever. Either you're gonna hate me or love me. I'm gonna do it regardless. Even though the record before that, if he kind of mimicked close to that, you figured that's a safe way of maintaining your success.
Yeah.
And he's where the world can see him. Like, everybody wants to criticize him and critique him. And he just does what he wants to do. And I respect that a whole lot. Like I said, you know, the music, you know, some of it, I'm like, I think it's really good. Some of it, you know, where I think, and on the same token, there's a brilliance in making those things work together, too, because you could take somebody like Jay-Z, and you could take any song from any album and make one album, and it doesn't sound like they do not belong. It doesn't belong. You know, you can make a greatest hits or just songs you like of Jay-Z from any record, from Reasonable Doubt to Present Date, and it goes, whoa, this is his new record? Like, it's seamless, you know what I'm saying? And he has the brilliance in a way of doing that as well, you know, so.
Yeah. One final RZA thing is, like, you had a not that well-known but and probably accidental part in the making of Wu-Tang Clan Ain't Nothing to Fuck With.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he used my record, man. Yeah, he sampled the beat underneath. I had to go to his house and get it.
So there was it was your record that he sampled from your collection.
Yeah, like it was just the beat, you know, just the beat. I'm not claiming everything else, and I'm not even claiming to make the beat. I don't want people to misconstrue it. I'm just saying that he's like, yeah, let me borrow this record from you, and I never got it back until I went to his house. I think they were recording Old Dirty. I remember they were recording Old Dirty time, and I went by his house. I'm going through his record. Yo, this is my record, man. You trying to keep this?
That was the underdog theme?
Nah. It was the Nobody Beats the Biz.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was just the beat underneath. And there was a scratch in it, I believe it was. And that's how you put that.
Yes, y'all.
That was the cover of Scratch in the record.
I be tossing and forcing, my style is awesome. I'm causing more family food than Richard Dawson. And the survey said, you're dead. Baby flying guillotine chops off your fucking head.
If you ever listen to that record, listen to it closely. There's a scratch that goes there, and he went and he covered it up with that, which was pretty slick, which turned out to be a significant part of the song.
Yeah.
At least the sound of it.
This conversation was a lot of fun, and I'm really looking forward to bringing the second half of it to you next week. I really like how we got a sense not only of how Paul's production style came together, but also his sense of humor with the stuff we talked about early on about his comedic influences. It was great to get so much history about Stetsasonic and about Paul's place in it to the extent that that group is talked about. You know, a lot of the focus rightfully is on Daddy-O, who was the leader. But it was great to have the history from Paul's perspective. You'll notice we didn't spend a ton of time talking about 3 Feet High and Rising. Among other factors, one of the main reasons for that is that the making of that record is documented exhaustively in Brian Coleman's awesome book, Check the Technique. We talked to Coleman in episode 80. If you want information about 3 Feet High and Rising or any number of other classic hip-hop records, his Check the Technique series of books is the place to go. Join us next week for part two of Prince Paul, where we discuss that time Everlast was a racist cop, Queen Latifah giving birth to the Soul Children, MF Doom and his gas face, and, of course, the Dicks. You can visit us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at The Cypher Show. Hit us up. Let us know what you thought of this episode, ideas for future guests, anything you'd want to talk about. You can also find this and any other of our episodes, along with special additional information, playlists, and lots more, at our website, thecyphershow.com. And again, don't forget to visit us at Patreon and iTunes. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
And he was also our music teacher at the school.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Man, like, cuts were everything to me.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Man, making records could be fun.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher. By the way, the thing at NYU was awesome. I was really glad I was able to finesse my way in there.
It was fun. It got me an opportunity to like actually take my daughter out, and she goes, "So that's what you do," you know. Like, it's funny, you know. Like, you know, every once in a while, like they'll show like VH1 clips of like some of the shows, you know, the countdown shows I'm on. And they go, "Wow, Daddy, you're on TV."